Hey, what's going on? It's At The Letters, Arden Zwelling here with Ben Nicholson Smith. Our producer is Christian Ryan, and we are very pleased to be welcoming back to the podcast this week the co-host of Lead Off on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and the pride of Oakville, Ontario, Scott MacArthur. Scotty, what's going on, man?
And you've already started this off with a lie. You're excited to have me on?
Are oh, the pride you... bit? The pride of Oakville, Ontario?
Well, no, I am that. Although Jamie Campbell might argue that point.
Acknowledged by Oakville, Ontario?
Well, I actually, you know what? I'm going to take this public platform opportunity to state something here. And maybe I should have somebody get me a Wikipedia page before I concern myself with this. But if you go to Oakville, Ontario's Wikipedia page, notable residents or notable people who were born there, Jamie Campbell's name is there and mine is not. So,
well,
the heart,
we need to
broken.
Get that changed.
No, don't get me a Wikipedia page. I don't want one.
Well, it's awesome to have you here, obviously. I am pleased to have you back on the podcast because we could talk about so many things with you, Scott. You know, we could talk about MLB labor and how infuriating this entire process has been to get baseball to where it is right now. We could talk Blue Jays, obviously, and what things might look like for them in a 60-odd game season. But before that, we want to get your thoughts on Pride Month, which has been occurring here throughout the month of June. And as I'm sure most of our listeners are aware, Scott, it's been just about 12 months since you came out last summer, which was obviously a very powerful and emotional moment for all of us who watched the video, and particularly for those of us who know you and have worked with you for a long time and had no idea. And so I'm just curious here off the top, man, like how you're reflecting on the last year since you put out the video, how different your life is now professionally, personally, mentally, emotionally, and just how you would sum up the experience of the last 12 months.
Well, I think I'll go through it chronologically. I guess there was a euphoria off the top, guys, where you've just done this monumental thing in your life. And I'll restate why I did it. I didn't do it for publicity, even though I knew there would probably be some publicity that came from it. I did it to unburden myself because I was living a split life. I was living a private life that sometimes would bleed into the public side of what I happen to do for a living. And I was trying to keep the secret private. And that was compromising my ability to live a full life. I found myself, and had been for years and I would say decades, micromanaging different messages for different people or different groups of people in my life. So I wanted to erase that burden, and I simply wanted to live authentically and give myself a chance at 40 years old at a better second half of my life than first half. Because my first few decades on this planet, and I've learned even more about that since coming out, my first few decades were difficult and have left me with some challenges that I'm still trying to overcome. So I did a lot of podcasts. I, you know, the Toronto Star very kindly, Laura Armstrong did a piece on me. Sean Fitzgerald sat me down and talked to my parents and brother and a friend and did a really nice piece on me in The Athletic. And then once all of that subsided, I met my partner, Xander, and we have been together since January, and he's been just amazing and wonderful part of my life. But in the early stages of our relationship, and I still consider that we are in the early stages of our relationship, almost 5 months in now, I have come to realize that there were a lot of things I was supposed to learn in my adolescence and young adulthood that I didn't learn because at about 11 or 12 years old, I emotionally shut down. I closed myself off, and I did that to protect myself and to protect my secret. It's something I felt I had to do growing up in early to mid-1990s Oakville, and it's something I felt I continued to have to do in order to not only break into the sports media industry, but then thrive in the sports media industry. And when you emotionally shut down, you don't only block out the bad, you also block out the good. You don't feel anything anymore. Or if you do feel something or start to feel something, you suppress it. So I have had a wonderful 11 or so months since the video came out. But when I say wonderful, I don't just mean it's all thumbs up great. I also mean some of the experiences have been a wonder. I've had to confront some of the suppressed emotions and feelings that I have had. I've had to forgive myself for decisions I've made. I've had to acknowledge, and I'm not entirely sure I've come to peace with it, but I've had to acknowledge a deep resentment that I previously didn't even recognize, a deep resentment for the industry in which I work, the industry in which we work, because I made a conscious decision at 22 or 23 years old that I had to stay in the closet in order to make it in this business. For a long time, I blamed myself. Xander, my boyfriend, has helped me to see that I was doing something to protect myself, that it was the industry, which wasn't necessarily overtly homophobic, but was covertly homophobic, and still in many ways is covertly homophobic. It was the industry that caused me to make that decision. So I still work in an industry for which I actually have learned I bear resentment. So I'm working through that, and I'm also trying to be a loving, compassionate, understanding boyfriend partner for a great man. And it has been a whirlwind. So the best thing I ever did was come out, but I can tell you guys, as a deeply introverted person who didn't realize how emotionally shut down he was, it's been scary at times too.
Yeah, wow. That sounds like a lot in a relatively short period of time. And it sounds like a lot of growth, Scotty. I mean, that sounds awesome, but also difficult in a lot of ways. I want to ask you about the industry. You know, we're all a part of it, and everyone listening obviously has an interest in sports and sports media. But before even we get to that, I do want to get a sense from you of how much you anticipated, you know, how turbulent in some ways the following year might be after you came out, and how much of it was just stuff that you couldn't possibly have anticipated, just given the magnitude of what you were jumping into it in an industry where not a lot of people take the plunge that you took a year ago.
Well, I mean, I do want to say that the people in the industry have been, and you two included, have been wonderful about it. To use a baseball term, I mean, this is a baseball podcast, I'm batting 1,000 in terms of the support I've received, at least the overt support. The covert stuff that may or may not be said behind my back, I don't even concern myself with. It's been great for me. In advance of the video, guys, I remember talking to people who'd either known my truth for a number of years or who had just learned my truth. And they said, well, what do you think? Like, how do you feel? I said, I've got no problem saying I'm gay. I've said that a number of times over the course of my life, dozens of times now. It's not the announcement. At the time, what I worried about was knowing my deeply introverted nature. Introversion is as much a part of my nature as is my homosexuality. So knowing my introverted nature, I wondered and worried about how an announcement such as this was going to affect that. Because what if I start getting asked to speak? Or what if I start getting asked to attend different events? And I've learned that in the COVID-19 period here, where everything's kind of been shut down, I've learned about myself that I actually did develop a case of being too busy. I didn't want to say no to anything. So many people have been wonderful that I wanted to give back in any way that I could. And what I've realized now isn't that I've got to, you know, sort of prioritize what is worthy of my time and what isn't. That's not what I'm saying. But what I need to do is focus more on taking care of myself. And what I've learned over the last 3 months while we've been in this shutdown and I've spent more time at home than even my introverted self would have enjoyed what I understand now is that any advocacy or activism that I do, at least in the near term, cannot be public facing as much as maybe some believe it should be, or even that I would have had anticipated it would be, because I am being confronted with so many things about myself that I need to work through, that until I knock some of those hurdles down in my own life, I'm not doing myself, let alone anybody else, any favors. If I'm just running around and doing a bunch of different things on different nights of the week, because if I'm doing all of that, all I'm ultimately doing is distracting myself and I'm not growing as a person. And when you spend an entire adolescence and young adulthood, your formative years, not learning the things you need to learn because you've closed such a significant chunk of yourself off to not only the rest of society, your family and your friends, but also to yourself, you find yourself playing a game of catch-up and you're trying to do it as quickly as possible. So I think that that has been one of the significant takeaways for me is that, and I don't want to sound too chicken soup for the soul-y when I say this or too self-help-like, it's kind of like I got to work on me for a little while. And so that has been something that I didn't quite anticipate, probably, Ben and Arden, because I didn't realize just how damaged I was by my very own existence. And that has now come to the forefront by being open.
Well, I don't think it's chicken soupy. It's incredibly relatable for me personally. Like when you want to talk about introversion and simmering resentment for the industry and not so simmering resentment for yourself and how you are around people and consuming yourself with work so that you can just kind of push all that to the background and ignore your personal issues. Like that's incredibly relatable. And the kind of ironic thing, I guess, is that, you know, you spent decades hiding something from the public, that being your nature. And then upon revealing it, now people like Ben and I ask you to show up and talk about it publicly over and over again by no choice of your own.
Well, yeah, except I put myself out there and I understood it. And I mean, I think it took me 2 minutes after seeing your email to say yes to coming on this podcast, because I consider the two of you good friends and also close colleagues. And so, you know, Xander, my boyfriend, and I have talked about this more than once. I have not been probably as vocal this month as I would have guessed I would have been if you'd asked me back in March or April, what do you think June's going to be like for you? I wouldn't have predicted that I would be quieter, but I do. Like, I trust you guys, and I know this is going to be a good conversation, and I want to share this part because I do believe, and Arden, I appreciate you saying that, this doesn't have to necessarily be about sexuality. This doesn't have to be about gender identity. This doesn't have to be about race, although all of those communities face these issues, I would imagine. This can be about anything going on in your life. You, Arden, you, Ben, you listening to this podcast. We all have stuff that scares us, that gives us fear. We all react in different ways to different stimuli dependent upon our genetics and our personality, but also the experiences we've had. What kind of family did we grow up in? What kind of circles did we run in with our friends, and how did those influence us? Societal pressures, peer pressures, all of these things. And it can be the scariest thing in the world to have to admit to someone you love, oh my God, I completely mishandled that, and now I got to figure out why I did. Oh my God, I completely mishandled that, because for the last 30 years, I didn't even realize this really till now, I've been a complete and total mess. But nobody's ever thought that, because here's Scott. He reads the news on the radio station in Ottawa, or Arden, you can ask Ben. Ben came into the CFRA newsroom up in Ottawa for a week as a student at Carleton University in 2009. That's when Ben and I first met. You know, I worked up there and I seemed to have it all together and I was living a total lie. Not professionally, but personally. And so all of these things affect me in my way that I've been through in the very same way that your life experiences affect you. And you know those life experiences far more than any of the rest of humanity ever would, because you're the only one who lives with you 24/7, 365, or in this case, it's 2020, 366. And if there's one year that didn't need an extra day, it's this year, by the way. So, you know, it's just kind of learning about ourselves as individuals. And that's, I think it's absolutely crucial. And it's about self-betterment and wanting better for ourselves, hoping better for others too. And if we all kind of get down that path, maybe society will become a better on the whole.
Well, I was going to say, you know, this period as well of, you know, the shutdowns that we're living through in quarantine and isolation has forced us all to live with ourselves for a little while. And, you know, like, you know, most of us at the stage of our life, you know, we have partners and whatnot, but like those people go to sleep and then it's just you and it's your thoughts and you are having to address a lot of these things. I think like I can certainly relate to that. Like, it, yeah. You know, it's funny to look at, you know, what you've gone through for the last 12 months, Scotty, and then to have this come and to like, you've almost been pushed and like forced into, as we all have, confronting a lot of these things.
Yeah. And I mean, I've joked with Xander and other people in my life, the last person who needs to spend an extra minute with himself is me. I have an overactive brain and I don't ever want to profess to be an expert on any of these topics. I'm an amateur psychologist, not a professional one. I don't have a PhD. I didn't do 10 years of schooling, but I have read up on introversion. And one of the pillars, it seems, based on what I've learned about it, is that introverts have overactive brains. The reason they don't need as much outside stimuli is because they got enough crap already jammed into their prefrontal cortexes and their frontal lobes that they got to sift through all of that, and it takes a ton of time to do it. And it's not an IQ thing. Extroverts just don't have as much of the stuff, if you will, jammed in there. And so spending so much time alone, to your point, Arden, it's like, oh my goodness, like I got to filter through all of this. And oh, this happened to me in grade 6, which influenced how I handled these situations throughout my high school years or my early 20s. And I heard someone cut a joke in grade 9 that I realize now pushed me just a little bit further into the closet. I struggled because I found myself attracted to some of my football teammates in high school, and I didn't know how to handle that. I'll tell you a story. Growing up in Oakville, I've joked that there was no homophobia in Oakville when I grew up there because there was no homosexuality. And that actually is a joke because there was homophobia, but it wasn't the overt stuff. It's what has come to be called, that a phrase or a term that I've heard used a lot, the microaggression, the microaggressions. So, you know, my parents are wonderful people, still married. Their 50th wedding anniversary will be in 2024. So they've been together for the better part of a half of a century. A lot of my friends who I grew up with, their parents are still married. My brother and sister-in-law are in a healthy marriage with two wonderful kids, my nephew and niece. I am surrounded and have traditionally been surrounded by healthy relationships, or at least what seem to be healthy relationships, but I was never exposed to a healthy gay relationship. I never had anyone to look up to as a kid. I didn't know any gay people when I grew up. As far as I was concerned, in Oakville, there weren't any. And then something happened, guys, in Oakville in the early 1990s. In the west end of the town, there is a big park, and it's called Shell Park. And in the early 1990s, police raided one evening or night, the public bathrooms at Shell Park, and found a number of men engaged in an orgy. And what happened was a number of those men's names at the time got published. And a lot of those men's lives were ruined, including one who was HIV positive, who ended up dying by suicide as a result of the shame. Shell Park, the two words, the one phrase, the two words, Shell Park, became something that whenever mentioned at high school was the subject of snickering, kind of like, ha ha, muttering Shell Park. Well, as a young gay kid who had no gay role models, who hadn't really ever met, to my knowledge, a gay person, or if I had, certainly had not had any conversations of any degree or length that would have granted me any insight, I began to perceive, this is through all some work that I've done that I better understand this now, I began to perceive that I must be like what happened in those public bathrooms. And that wasn't me. That wasn't the life I wanted to live. And then I also thought, it's probably not the life those men wanted to live. So what is it that has happened to them or that society has done to them to push them down that path? And why is it that they have now been publicly shamed? Why is it that they are going through all of this embarrassment? I don't know if these are married men with families. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. What has happened to them personally outside of the man who died by suicide? I have no idea, and I would love to know. But my impression of what it was to be gay, as I started to understand that I myself was gay, was that you meet in public bathrooms and have clandestine sex, and that you're not capable of maintaining and having healthy, functional relationships, either partnerships or friendships or family relationships. And I was mortified. So that's an example of something that I've had to come to a realization of and work through, that a lot of my damage about who I am dates all the way back almost 30 years.
Yeah, it's such a shame that there was so much shame directed toward gay people, you know, at that time. And some of that still exists, but it's crazy. And Scotty, I think you make a good point by mentioning the kind of models that we see in society, right? And, you know, so often you're watching an old, you know, episode of a TV show, for example, and are there a lot of gay characters? Not really. Are there trans characters in the 90s TV shows? No way. There just is not a lot of modeling for that. And obviously that impacts the perception and it impacts people's real lives. And it's when you said the line that there weren't gay people in Oakville, it kind of reminds me of Major League Baseball, right? Because as far as anyone knows publicly, there aren't gay people in Major League Baseball. There are no openly gay players. There has never been an openly gay player in Major League Baseball when that player is active in the league. Billy Beane and others have come out afterwards, but not during their careers. And so these are kind of related issues, but now it's 2020 and there still are not any openly gay players, even though the player pool has 1,200 people and you have to assume that many of them are gay, not just one or two. So I'd love to hear your insight as to why that is. And, you know, not that you would know any, you know, concrete answer necessarily, but what do you think about baseball and the kind of models that this sport that we love shows to or reflects back to the world and this audience that's obviously a lot more varied than what we see on the field?
I'm going to give you an answer to that question that is different than one I've given before. And the one I've given before, I feel, is kind of the meat and potatoes prototypical answer. So throw you a bit of a change up. You might have put the one down for the fastball, and I'll Marco Estrada and come at you 10 miles per hour slower. There is an element of the fact that there absolutely are gay men playing baseball, hockey, basketball, football. Let's just start with that premise, and they just have not gotten to the point where they feel like they can come out. There is fear there, and I understand that fear. But I'm going to set that aside. I know, including my boyfriend, who is tremendously athletic, I know a number of gay men who tell me that they absolutely hate sports. Now, that doesn't mean they don't like playing in a softball league or playing in a flag football league or soccer or whatever. They hate sports. And it's kind of like the Toronto Argonauts in Toronto. Nobody seems to care about the Argos, but they seem to care about telling you why they don't care. Well, with gay men in sports, a lot of gay men that I've talked to, there's a simmering resentment. When I was a little boy, I liked baseball or I liked hockey or whatever, but then I started getting picked on. Then I started getting mocked because maybe I had effeminate tendencies or, you know, people would make fun of my voice or my laugh or my mannerisms. Like, whatever the case may be, the stories can vary. But there is a simmering, just beneath the surface, resentment for sports. And it's not so much the sports themselves, but it's the culture around them. Here's the flip side of the answer, Ben and Arden. How many potentially brilliant baseball players, hockey players, basketball players, soccer players, football players, name your team sport, how many brilliant athletes never got anywhere close to the best leagues in the world for their respective sports because they said to hell with this long before they were sniffing the big leagues? I guarantee you, we have been robbed at least one Hall of Famer in each sport because the sports culture told them, you're not welcome here. And I'm not talking about using the three-letter or, to stretch it out, the six-letter F word, the overt stuff. I'm talking about the microaggressions, the mocking. I'm very happy to say I face no homophobia at work since coming out. But every now and then you hear somebody kind of cut a joke, and it's totally innocent joke. There's no problem with it. And it's followed up with, I don't swing that way. And it's just like an innocent comment. They don't even realize they're saying it. And I haven't done it yet, but I might the next time if I hear it again, I might jump in and say, and if they did swing that way, what? Does that make them less? Is there a problem with that? Because you're just implying there that that makes them different and we should be celebrating our differences, not ignoring them, by the way. I believe that. But does that difference make them less? So it's just all of that stuff. And people will tell you that the carnival barkers who have been on our television sets for decades, making fun, using lisps and accents and saying certain athletes are lesser than because they don't play the tough game or whatever, those carnival barkers have ruined sports for people. And then the microaggressions personally experienced, and I'm speaking more on gay boys, gay men's issues here than anything else. The community is massive. That's all combined to push people away. And so that's where we've got to get to. It's got to start. I mean, it would be nice if it would just start now in major league clubhouses and NHL locker rooms and all that stuff, but it's actually going to start at the grassroots level. And hopefully the generation coming up and the one that will follow and will follow that and will follow that and will follow that will be more open to all genders, to all sexualities, to all races, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You and I will long be dead before humanity has this perfect, if it ever gets to perfection. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't be trying.
You know, you mentioned how your answer to questions like that has evolved from maybe the one that you would give 12 months ago. And like, just listen to you talk right now, Scotty. Like, you just, it's a lot more raw and heated right now, the way that you're answering questions about some of this stuff that maybe, you know, right after you came out, 12 months ago. And like, I wonder if there is a reason for that. You know, I think that we forget that Pride Month here in June was actually, you know, it's in June because of the Stonewall riots, because of those demonstrations, you know, 50 some years ago now, because of similarly a violent police raid at a gay bar in New York. And, you know, here in Canada, we've had raids on bathhouses, and the statistics are clear that deaths by suicide among gay men far outpace deaths by suicide among straight men. It does seem like you are being a lot more direct and harsh in the way that you talk about these things now. I like it.
Yeah, well, and here's the other one, Arden, because it's Operation Soap was 81, if I'm not mistaken, 81, 82. And the men who stood up to the cops on Church Street then are the heroes of early day gay rights in this city. But there was a serial killer, okay? A serial killer killing gay men in this city 3 years ago. And he was picking on new immigrants, gay men who didn't have a lot of connections in Toronto, in Ontario, in Canada yet. He was picking on marginalized people. And when these people would disappear, that would either go unnoticed because of their lack of connectivity, or when it did go noticed and it was pointed out, police in some cases would say, well, maybe they just picked up and moved away. Well, you know, it's kind of a transient culture. And people were saying, there is someone, we don't know who it is, but there is someone killing people in our community. I have a friend, boys. I have a friend who now lives in Paris, but he lived here at the time. And he told me that unbeknownst to himself, he actually saved a friend of his from Bruce MacArthur. Because his friend had unknowingly and unwittingly, obviously, started communicating with Bruce MacArthur online. And Bruce MacArthur offered this guy, who was in need of money, $5,000 to come spend a night at his apartment. And my friend, upon finding this out, thank goodness his friend mentioned this to him, my friend said, you are not going to whoever that is for $5,000. If you need money, I'll lend it to you. And that's what he did. And that guy, because he lent him the money, didn't go to Bruce MacArthur's house and didn't die. So these are things that happen to marginalized communities that are absolutely heartbreaking. And for me, to get back to some of what we were talking about earlier, it's about finding a voice and understanding where I can best be of help. But these are stories that need to be told. And I thought to myself, Arden, because when you and Ben initially emailed me, you were the one who typed out the email, and you said, we'll talk a little bit about Pride. And I thought to myself, I said, I can't come on and just be kumbaya. Like, I can't just paint the flag waving, happy-go-lucky, oh my God, the last 11 months have been completely and totally unbelievable. I've had a wonderful 11 months in so many ways, Xander being at the top of the list, and friends that I've made and people that I've met and opportunities that I've had. But I've also had to learn and am learning so much about myself. I'm also having to push through a lot of my difficulties, get over myself in some ways, and understand that, you know, I'm a damaged person as a result of the life I've lived. And I think to your point about my intensity is that I have hated myself for almost all of my life. And so that is kind of seeping out of my pores now in different ways, maybe in a little bit of intensity here as I talk about these issues passionately, but I'm healing. I'm trying to get through all of this so that I can be more productive for myself, my partner, my family, my friends, my employers, my colleagues at work. I can just generally be better as we go forward. That's the aim.
And you talk about, you know, Pride and kumbaya, like things get smoothed out over time, right? Something that started as a protest, something that started as LGBT people rising up and advocating for police reform and for equal rights. It's such an inelegant comparison, but it is similar to what we've seen from the Black community over the last several months and some of the demonstrations that have been occurring across North America. And Ben and I talked about them a lot last week, about watching people of color march and protest in response not only to the murder of George Floyd, but to the murders of countless young Black members of society at the hands of law enforcement and you know, really generations of systemic widespread racism. Like, I have to think that as you watch that play out, obviously separate communities, separate issues, you know, very different times in history. But, you know, as you watch that, that had to resonate a bit more personally with you just because of the movement that you feel so passionately about.
Again, I don't want to speak for the Black community, but you can go back 50 years, Martin Luther King. How far have we come in the last 50 years? That is for a Black person to answer. That is not for a white person to determine and speak about. Because if you want a prime example of white privilege, look at what happened to George Floyd. Meanwhile, there's a traitor in the White House. That's me saying that. I'm not putting words in your mouth. I'll own those words. You want an example of white privilege? Look at the grift and the greed of the president of the United States and that administration full of white people. That is white privilege, and there are Black people on the streets protesting systemic racism. And it isn't just policing, but policing was birthed out of really the development of North America after North America was colonized. You know, we see things like, well, this isn't what Canada is, or this isn't what the United States is. Says who? Racism is in the foundation of the development of the culture that has existed for the last 400 or 500 years on this continent. Our ancestors, mine, at some point came over. And at that time, there were Black people being taken from their homes, their villages, their towns in Africa against their will and brought over here to work long hours in the hot sun for little money or no money, and they became the property of their owners, of their white owners. And we sit here and we go, this isn't who we are. Well, actually, yes, it is who we are. And it continues, the effects of that continue to be felt for the generations and generations and generations that have followed. And all they are asking for is to be heard. And not just to be heard, but to be understood. And if we can't understand them because we are not Black, to at least try to understand them. And that doesn't mean that you and I feel guilty for being white. We no more chose our skin color than we chose our sexual orientation. But they didn't choose their skin color either, and they have been repressed, and they have been mistreated forever because of something, their skin color, that they didn't choose. It is stunning that we either are not able to wrap our heads around this fact, or in so many cases are unwilling to try to wrap our heads around this fact. And what we need to create a more just society is understanding. And then from there, a willingness to work together to change things.
Throughout all your answers here, there's such an openness to discussing this and kind of discussing your own personal perspective on this, which, you know, you already had decades of it, you know, before last year. And then in the last year, you've obviously experienced some different things. And a lot of that seems positive, which is awesome and great to hear. And yet, as we look at this industry that we're in, the sports media industry, you don't see a lot of people out. And, you know, you mentioned yourself reflecting on your young adulthood, or your teenage years, and, you know, you kind of think about how valuable it would be, how motivating and inspirational potentially, or just validating it could be for a young person in that community to see themselves reflected in the current sports media landscape. It's not something that we see a lot of right now. What do you think that could look like 5-10 years from now? What do you think are some of the steps that in our world you would like to see taken to make that transition easier, to make it easier for those people to be themselves without any fear of judgment?
Well, I mean, I do know, and I'm not overly familiar with the details of this, but I do know that Ryerson University's sports media program has teamed up with Sportsnet and will avail itself of Rogers Human Resources to work on diversity in our workplace, to focus more on the promotion of that and to ensure that LGBTQ plus and other minority students have opportunities. And so I think programs like that are a really good start as long as they are seen through. I do think that I'm encouraged on a couple of fronts, not the least of which is that I've had some people either in the industry, not a lot, so I want to be clear, it's not like there have been a dozen or dozens, but there have been some people who have reached out to me and shared with me their own stories regarding sexual orientation or gender identity, but that they're not quite there yet in terms of being comfortable to disclose that and to share that. And so I think the day is coming where we're just going to have people being people. And that doesn't mean that we whitewash everything and, you know, he's straight and she's gay and whatever, and we just kind of become one homogenized group. But I do envision a day where we get to a point where you can go to the company holiday party in early December and you see somebody you work with who's a guy holding hands with his boyfriend. You could see two women holding hands and it's just kind of like, oh, hey, nice to meet you. Like it doesn't matter quite as much anymore. I do think we're going to get to that point. And I do think it's important to have that door open. And it isn't just like me being like, hey, everybody, I'm gay, I'm a trailblazer. It's as much or maybe even more, Ben and Arden, about two people like you who, if you encounter somebody in the industry who, of any age, but especially young people, because they're the ones coming up and looking to carve their own niches, but whoever you encounter in this industry who happens to be openly gay, openly lesbian, you know, a transgendered individual, like whatever the case may be, that it's just kind of like, hey, not only am I good with it, but if you're struggling in any area or if you're having a problem with somebody or if you're sensing that something isn't going your way because of who you are, I'll advocate with you. I'll stand beside you. I won't speak for you unless you ask me to, but I'll stand with you. So I do think another term that is new to me and that is more in the lexicon now than it ever has been is allyship. I do think we need allies. We need people to come alongside us. Nobody is here to take other people's jobs, I would hope, but a gay man, a lesbian woman, a transgendered person, a black person, a brown person, an Asian person, they want the same crack at the gig that we get. And so I hear some people talk about you get jobs on merit. We need a meritorious society. You know what? I am absolutely in favor of a meritorious society, provided that opportunities are equal. So if I run the 100-meter dash against Usain Bolt, and Usain Bolt has to start 100 meters from the finish line, and I'm 5 meters from the finish line in my starting blocks, it doesn't matter that he's the fastest person in the world. I'm going to beat him. If the opportunity isn't equal, it doesn't matter how smart or talented some people are. They're not going to get the opportunities in the first place because people who begin with an advantage, even if it's an unrecognized advantage, end up with the gig. And that's where we've got to get to. We have got to get to a point where the subconscious bias is brought to the conscious level, and nothing about a person's nature is the determining factor to the negative about why they do or don't get a gig.
And hopefully on some level, like us having conversations like this will help that, because there have been opportunities to have these conversations in the past when you look at baseball and like the Toronto Blue Jays. There's been a couple ugly moments here in recent history where we could have had these conversations. And I wonder if we didn't have them to the extent that we should have. Like, I'm thinking about Yunel Escobar taking the field with a gay slur written on his eye black. I'm thinking about Kevin Pillar using a slur to taunt an opponent during a game. I'm thinking about the fact that the Toronto Blue Jays were one of the final MLB franchises to actually begin a Pride Night, which, you know, isn't like some sort of revolutionary thing. It's just a very small token. And it took a long time for the Blue Jays to actually have one of those. And like, even Scotty, like, I think, like, I don't have your career trajectory in front of me, but I'd imagine that if you weren't hosting a show, you might have actually been covering the team at that point. You were definitely on the radio talking about these things as a closeted gay man. So, you know, I'd be curious to hear even just how you process discussing those incidents, and even just how, now looking back on it, maybe we missed opportunities to actually have these discussions at the time.
Well, I remember specifically the Pillar situation. I was working at the Three Letters at the time, and I was doing the 1-4 show on TSN 1050. And I did a 15-minute as a closeted gay man who had begun to open up about my mental health challenges at that time. Because it was, I think Pillar, was it Jason Mott? I can't remember who it was. It doesn't matter. The Atlanta pitcher. But I remember the previous January on Bell Let's Talk Day, I had begun to really open up about some of the harrowing mental health stuff that I'd been through. I just didn't share what was the crux of the reason behind it. So there had been like an authentic layer that I guess I had brought to my career, if you will, for lack of a better way to put it. And I did a 15-minute thing on Pillar, and I said, you know, you cannot say that that's a one-off. If that's the word on the tip of your tongue when you're brushed back or you're hit with a pitch, that means you use it elsewhere. If a guy drilled me in the back with a pitch and I was that upset about it, I'd probably scream a-hole at him or something like that, because that's a word I use. The three-letter F-word or the six-letter F-word, that's not on the tip of my tongue, so it ain't going to come out of my mouth in an incident like that. But I remember saying at the time, I said, this doesn't have to be what defines Kevin Pillar. Because I think what Kevin Pillar should do is he should come back to Toronto with help, because it's not as if things like this would be obvious to him, but with help, find a community group in the LGBTQ plus community. Preferably, although it doesn't have to be, but preferably youth. And meet some of these marginalized and disadvantaged teenagers who have been chased from their homes by unaccepting parents, who've maybe lived in shelters or spent nights on the streets and are just trying to figure out not only who they are, which is difficult enough as it is when you're in adolescence, but how they're going to survive and ultimately thrive in a world that has told them they're not welcome. And if you go with the intent to listen, not to reply to what you hear, but with the intent to truly listen and learn and understand, you'll come away with a different perspective. And you'll understand maybe why that three-letter F word hurts so much. You know that the three-letter F word in UK and British terminology is cigarettes, right? How do you smoke a cigarette? You burn it. Well, you know how the F word got attached to gay people? Gays used to get burned at the stake. That's where that word comes from. That's why it hurts. So if we educate ourselves about how this all came to be, we gain a better understanding. I can't sit here and blame Kevin Pillar for potentially not having any exposure to the LGBTQ plus community. I don't know the life that he led when he grew up. It could just be born out of ignorance, a word that he has heard or maybe has used or both through the years. He might not much know any better. He doesn't need to be canceled, but he can take this opportunity to learn. And it sounds as though he did that. And it sounds as though he wasn't looking for publicity when he did that. It's just that John Laud, great reporter, and maybe one or two others afterward, went to him and asked him about it. And he was kind of sheepish, saying, I don't really know if I want to talk about this, but that they got it out of him. So it didn't look like he was looking for publicity or for any kind of repair of his reputation. He went out and he put in the work. I don't know if it affected him at all, if it changed his point of view, if he hasn't used the term since or if he has, but I looked at it as no need to cancel Kevin Pillar, and I hope that he takes this opportunity to meet some people he otherwise never would have met, hear their stories, and learn from them. That's what I hoped for at the time.
Right. And there's so many, you know, even as you're talking there, Scotty, I thought back to the example of John Gibbons saying, I guess we'll come out wearing dresses tomorrow. Maybe that's what everybody wants.
Oh, after, my God, I forgot about that.
After a game in 2016, right? And it's, these are just with the team that we cover, the Toronto Blue Jays, and in the last decade, and these are the public events. So it just underscores, I mean, how much room there is to move forward and advance the discussion and have a way more tolerant, way less ignorant discussion. And Scotty, I think in all of your work, you know, publicly, even for an introvert, you're bringing a lot, I think, to this discussion.
Well, and sure, just because you brought up John Gibbons, I did phone Gibby the week before my video came out, and I told him, and he could not have been better about it. And it wasn't just that he said, Scotty, you're you. That's great. It didn't stop there. We just kept talking. And then he asked me a question. And you know how, like, Gibby had that reputation as kind of being dumb as a fox, which is to say, he's a lot smarter than he lets on when he gets to rambling. Like, people had this impression that he was this kind of yokel from Texas. He's a smart man. He asked me something that to this day has stuck with me. He said, can I ask you a question? And I said, yeah. He said, I always found you to be somebody who was interested in me and my life or interested in the lives of others. Were you trying to understand me better because all you've ever wanted to be is understood yourself? John Gibbons asked me that question. I thought, oh my God, he didn't just take in my information and say, I'm good with it, we're friends forever. He thought about it. In the span of the same phone call, he came up with the most profound question that I've been asked by anybody since I either told them personally in advance of the video or since the video came out. He gets it.
That's a really cool story. And it reminds us, I guess, in a sense that, man, like Gibby, he's a really open, tolerant person. But even then, you know, up until recently, a lot of people in that category have used language that can be damaging. And to take nothing away from what's a really cool story there, Scotty, you know, with that being said, we also want to hear from you on Major League Baseball. You, of course, follow this stuff. You have covered this league for a long time now.
Oh, if you thought I was fired up before.
here comes the real Scott MacArthur fire. There's a lot of frustration here. You've loved baseball, you know, your whole life, the entire time I've known you. And the state of the game right now is disappointing. I think everyone listening knows that what's happening with between the players and owners right now. They're at a standoff as we record this on Thursday, early afternoon here. What do you make of it all? What's your perspective on everything that's been unfolding right now between the players and owners?
I've said it on Leadoff on Sportsnet 590 The Fan more than once. Just let me know when you know. Like, if we're having a season, let me know when it starts and for how many games and what the playoffs are going to look like. If we're not having a season, just let me know so that I can call you stupid and stupidity wins, and then I'll move on and we'll focus on the NBA, the NHL, and whatever else may or may not come back. I typically am pro-player and am pro-player in this situation, but at some point it is about the need, as long as the proper health protocols are taken. That needs to be the disclaimer here. COVID-19 is bigger than all of this. So if human health, player health is at risk, they can't come back. But setting that aside, this is all about the, to put it diplomatically, contentious negotiation that is impending over the next collective bargaining agreement, because this one expires on December the 1st of 2021. And for the first time in almost three decades, it seems as though there will be labor war instead of labor peace. A divided players' union has coalesced and seems to be in agreement that they got fleeced in the last CBA. Their union head, Tony Clark, is under a lot of pressure to, if nothing else, perhaps recoup some of what was lost, or at least hold firm, because the players have seen salaries suppressed. I know that that sounds crazy in a world where Mike Trout is making $35 million a year. The truth of the matter, though, is Mike Trout's worth about $80 to $90 million a year, but he's making $35. I know that sounds crazy, but salaries have been suppressed either through service time manipulation. Owners are not breaking rules, neither are general managers, by the way. So that might be something that has to be addressed. Change the law, change the rule, negotiate that if you can get that in. We've got a luxury tax threshold that serves for some teams as a de facto salary cap. There are a lot of the free agency market used to be settled around the winter meetings in December. We now have players like Bryce Harper going into spring training without long-term contracts. You know, before he signed with Philadelphia, we were in Clearwater the day he arrived. It was early March. The Jays were playing the Phillies in a Grapefruit League game in 2019. So they've got a lot of issues that they want to settle. This is like a football field. You need both sides at the 50-yard line, but both have driven their stakes deep into the ground at their respective goal lines. And this is a precursor to the larger fight that's coming.
It's a very how the sausage is made time and moment in baseball right now.
And you make to want to be a vegetarian, right?
Right, exactly. You know, like we all love a good spicy Italian, charred and grilled and with, you know, relish and all the fixings and everything. But the last few months have kind of shown you how that sausage gets to your plate and what it's like at the killing fields, you know, and well, how these pigs
are raised.
Oh my God,
the hot dog really is disgusting and jammed full of nitrates. Yeah.
Right. And it's, you know, it's exhausting. It's disheartening, you know, it's rancid, right? Being pro player, as I think the three of us certainly are, I mean, it's often pretty easy to be that way because it just means that you're pro labor. Realistically, like if you take the zeros off the paychecks and you just look at it as a macrocosm of what all of us go through at our workplaces and what laborers go through at theirs, and you know, the guys who you know, hold the stop and yield sign on construction sites and this, that, it's no different. It is just the figures and the vocation that is different. So it's pretty easy to be pro player, but I think that what has kind of at least turned things a bit more towards progress this week is that the majority of public sentiment has been anti-owner. And I do wonder if the owners kind of smartened up a little bit and said, oh, wait, the game is our product and the players are our product and we need to sell our product at the end of this. And right now, everybody hates our product. And right now, everybody hates us. And the players have brought this like stroke of brilliance with the when and where campaign and that simple direct messaging that really put the heat on the owners in this. And I wonder if that's why we've seen the two sides actually get to the table and talk face to face. Because if we end up with this 50-65 game season, that could have been sorted out a long time ago. Like that could have been sorted a while ago. That was very easy. That like compromise was right there. That lane was right there for these two sides to take. But as you alluded to, so much of this has not really been about, you know, reaching a conclusion. It has been about negotiating and staking out positions and thinking about 2021 and the future fight that is going to be fought then. Like so much of it, Scotty, has been about what goes into the sausage.
Well, what I wonder, guys, is if ultimately we get an agreement for 2020 and maybe even 2021 with the universal DH, and maybe we've actually hit a point where a pitcher will never hit in Major League Baseball again, the expanded playoffs for this year and next, which would take next year's uncertainty into consideration. Will fans be allowed back into stadiums? And even if they are, will they want to go back in the numbers that traditionally baseball would expect? So will that expanded playoff lead to expanded broadcast revenue that would offset some of the gate losses, et cetera, et cetera? But when you get down to it, it is impossible for Joe or Jill Q Public to relate to the dollars being discussed. But I think if you whittle it down to this simple fact, if I work a day, I want a day's pay. And if I work tomorrow, I want to be paid for tomorrow's work. The owners to this point have been, up until at least the last 24 hours or so, looking to extract from the players another pay cut in the form of, we will pay you a percentage of your prorated salary. So they've already taken prorated per the March agreement. Now we want to take another percentage away from you off of what is prorated. And players are saying, no, I work today, I want to be paid for it. I work tomorrow, I want to be paid for it. And so where I think we get to now is a position where if a deal is struck, both sides can say they won. Owners all along maybe have had about the 35% of revenue number they were willing to devote in this unprecedented year to player salary. So they come up with a number of games where players are paid their full prorated salary. As you said, Arden, the 50 to 60 or 65 game number that could have been settled on 3 months ago, although COVID-19 was a moving target. We didn't know how long it would last, how long restrictions would be in place, what different jurisdictions would suffer massive outbreaks, which would be quieter, whether those would change, all of that stuff. So owners pay the players approximately 35% of the revenue. Players then get to say, we are getting our full prorated salaries each and every day. The owners ultimately get what they wanted all along. The players say, we stood firm, we held tall, and we've gotten our full prorated salaries for whatever season we're going to play. Both sides can either claim victory or feel as though they legitimately won. The owners get what they want in terms of that percentage dedicated to player payroll. The players are getting prorated. We got baseball. We've got expanded playoffs. They get out before the start of November, where there's a concern of a second wave of COVID-19. Everybody's as happy as is possible. But bumpy roads are ahead. We're certainly in one now, and it's weird to think that this might just be the start of a problem as opposed to the end of one.
Yeah, it's a lot of moving pieces, especially, you know, you think second wave and we still got that first wave, and you look at Orange County in Florida around the Orlando area, which is not far from Tampa, not far from Dunedin. There's a lot of hurdles there, but it does seem like we're going to see some sort of season agreed upon, and whether it's 60 or 66 or 70 games, who knows, but there likely will be a season. And Scotty, I'd love to know your thoughts here on what that will mean for the Jays. And, you know, maybe it's, again, a product of, you know, we've watched some pretty bad baseball the last few years. We've watched our Alan Hansen and Socrates Brito and Ryan Furuben fix. And it's kind of fun to contemplate a season where you might have Ryu and Pearson and Bichette. Like, what are you expecting for the 2020 edition of the Blue Jays on the field?
Austin Martin leading off in game one, or am I a little too far out to lunch on that one?
Sign me probably up. A little I'd
too
watch
far.
That.
Yeah, I'm a little too, probably a little too far out to lunch on that point. Look, I'm willing to go a little crazy here, and don't spoil my fun. Let's just say they play 65 games, probably an even number of games. So 64, 66, like whatever. And let's just say that Hyunjin Ryu is healthy and makes 10 starts. And let's just say we're not concerned about service time. You're either getting a full year or you're not, more or less. There's no minor league baseball. So Nate Pearson is up and he makes 10 starts. And that 104 mile an hour fastball is as major league ready as it's talked about being. And let's just say Matt Shoemaker holds up and looks as good or close to as good as he did for the 4 or 5 starts that he made for the Blue Jays last April. You piece together Tanner Roark and Chase Anderson, and you figure out your bullpen, suddenly you're 7-3 out of the gate, and you've only got 50 or 55 more games left. Oh, and you're dealing with an expanded playoff. Maybe you become a really interesting team. Like, maybe you've got a shot at not necessarily going deep in an expanded playoff, but getting into an expanded playoff. I think that that's the best case scenario. Longer term, and I know you didn't ask this, if they go universal DH, which the deal that's proposed or the quote framework proposes for this year and for next, I don't think we'll ever see a pitcher hit in baseball again. I am an advocate of the traditional American League DHs, National League pitchers hit. I do like the juxtaposition of strategies. But if we are going to go homogenized here, then as far as I'm concerned, long-term, scrap the two leagues. If they're both going to be the same, scrap them, because I don't think Fox would mind a New York Yankees-Boston Red Sox World Series. I don't think Fox would mind a Los Angeles Dodgers-San Francisco Giants California rivalry World Series, Cubs Cardinals. I don't know what you'd do with the divisions, what you'd do with the leagues or the conferences or whatever you'd call them, how you'd apportion out schedules and who plays who and how much and all of that stuff. But if you want to get crazy, long term, get crazy. I do say, regardless of what happens with the Blue Jays this year, I've turned a corner on my perception of this team. The next step for them to take, now that they've got, don't call them Aston Martin, they got a brand new sports car that they're trying to get signed and that they're going to have in their garage here to come out and play for them in a couple of years. They get Aston Martin signed. Now that they got all these young prospects, they got all these up-the-middle talents dotted throughout the organization. You guys both talked to Ross Atkins. If you ask him to list the team's shortstops, he needs more than two hands at this point. The next step, and it's not now, maybe it's a year from now, is to identify who is absolutely untouchable and then who is appealing to other teams, but that you're willing to part with, and you do a package deal and you start to bring in maybe an arm, maybe a position player to either add to the core or to supplement the young core. And then all of a sudden you look around and you go, my God, we got a contender here. So what they do with their prospect capital in the next year to 2 years, outside of the on-field performance of everybody, the actual games themselves, that's what's most fascinating to me, because I think they're close.
It's funny how the tone changes, isn't it? I'm sure you can look back at the conversations you were having on leadoff in September, barreling towards a 95 loss season, and how grim it was and how bleak it was at the time. Remember last trade deadline and the Stroman deal, the Aaron Sanchez trade that fans were absolutely like apoplectic about? You know, since the end of a 95 game season, the Blue Jays haven't played. They haven't played a single game, and yet the conversation around the team is a lot more positive now. Maybe those two things are related.
the Ryu signing helps, right, Arden? Because it shows that they're willing to spend. And they may have spent a little more on Ryu than other teams would ever, maybe not spent more, but given an extra year of term in order to secure him. It showed the market something. I think that there was a pivot in the thought of this front office and this team when they locked him in.
And so when you look at those 8 months or so, 10 months, whatever it's been since the end of last season, you see the Ryu signing and you see Austin Martin added to the organization. Nate Pearson's arrival at spring training, just blowing, you know, 101 miles an hour past everybody. You see this as a net positive these last few months for the franchise, despite the fact they haven't played a game. They're unproven on the field. There's still plenty of question marks when it comes to the outfield and whether this rotation is going to hold up. Will Hyunjin Ryu be able to stay healthy? Will Matt Shoemaker be able to stay healthy? Will Nate Pearson just hit the ground running when he gets to the big leagues? Or will he struggle as many young players do? What's Vladimir Guerrero Jr. going to be? Is he going to be able to live up to his expectations? And even, you know, from a much more broader angle, no Blue Jays player has been playing a game. Young players who need to be developing and need reps against high-level competition, they haven't been getting it. And they haven't been getting that development that they need right now. Like, no, you know, the Blue Jays are uniquely hurt right now by not playing games, in that they need to expose all those young players that you were talking about to that level of competition so they can continue to learn and make adjustments and get better. But it sounds to me you still see this period as a net positive for the franchise.
Yeah, I mean, the COVID-19 stuff killing the minor league season and some of the developmental difficulties that will come as a result of that. I take your point, Arden, the Jays being young and having so many prospects, it might hurt them more than a team that is veteran, ready to contend now, has most of its prime talent at the major league level and is trying to rebuild its farm system or maintain it or sustain it or however you want to put it. So I understand that. And I take all your points about, will Ryu stay healthy? Will Pearson be able to find the strike zone, or whatever discussions we can have about individual players? But I do think on the whole, you can see that there are a ton of players in the system who have value either to this Blue Jays team or to another team, who may run into some, you know, financial issues, or maybe there's a controllable player who's getting too expensive in arbitration for another organization who might have like 2 or 3 years left of control, and maybe there's a trade to be made, and then all of a sudden you got a guy under control who then comes here and falls in love with the city and signs long term, kind of like a Christian Yelich in Milwaukee, who can be a part of the core or a key piece of the core. Like, I just think there are still so many moving parts to come. There have been many moving parts in the last 6 to 8 to 10 months. There are more parts here that are going to move. Using Ryu as a specific example, the reason I liked the signing so much is that at the time, you know, it's a 4-year contract. I don't know what the new CBA is going to look like, but let's just presume the arbitration eligibility and all that stays the same or thereabouts. Like, Ryu's contract is over before Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Bo Bichette, and anybody else becomes even remotely prohibitive financially for this team. And prohibitive is a term I use kind of loosely, because it's not like this organization can't afford to pay these guys when they start to get a little more expensive. So I think they've done a pretty good job. I do think there are a lot of questions still about the long-term starting rotation. Again, I believe that some of that is going to be addressed through trade. And then you also have to hope that, like, longer term, a Simeon Woods Richardson, if he's not part of a trade package for more of a now player, or like an Anthony Kay at the bottom of the rotation, or any one of the other number of names that you could get, you got to kind of hope that a couple of guys find it as Blue Jays and a couple of other guys are used as trade bait to fill in other spaces. I think there's a lot of ways this could go. I was down on it like a year ago, having to watch that every single day, but I see the plan. I can't guarantee the plan is going to work, but I see the plan. I remember walking up to Anthony Rizzo at the 2014 All-Star Game in Minneapolis, and the Cubs had traded Jeff Samardzija to the Athletics for Addison Russell, Billy McKinney, and I remember walking up to Anthony Rizzo, and I said, so what do you make of this Samardzija deal? He doesn't know me from Adam, man. Like, I'd never met Anthony Rizzo in my life at that point, and he said, I see the plan. I see what they're doing. You know, of course, the next offseason, the Cubs signed John Lester. 2 years later, they were on their way to winning a World Series. I'm not saying that's where the Blue Jays will get to in such a short period of time, but I think we can at least acknowledge that we see the plan. What we have to hope is that the plan works out.
Scotty, when we asked you to come on the podcast, I knew we were going to get some intelligent, insightful Blue Jays analysis. I knew we were going to get some honesty and some candor and some perspective. And I knew that you would find a way to work it back to the Chicago Cubs. And you have done so, sir. You have done it.
Oh, calling me out. Yeah, I can't even deny it, too. I can't even deny it.
Scott, we thank you so much, man. It's been awesome to get your perspective on these things and to hear your commentary and to hear your honesty and to hear some things that don't get said on sports podcasts nearly enough. So we thank you so much for this.
Well, you guys shared your platform. I love the podcast. I listen all the time. I'm available anytime you need me. And if one of you is on vacation, I'm not demanding that I co-host, but if I am asked, I probably will accept.
We'll take you up on that. Thanks, Scotty.
All right, boys. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. I'm Arden Zwelling, Ben Nixon-Smith. Christian Ryan is our producer. We'll talk to you next time on At the Letters.